Let me get to the next one. I'll address your issue. So if there are individuals who can develop like a Reb Shimon Bar Yochai model, whose responsibility is it to make sure it happens? It's the community's responsibility. We're talking about scholars. Okay, we're not talking about average Joes. We're talking about scholars. I'm talking just like the government pours money into research. Right? They understand we've got to do research and find cures for diseases. The Jewish people have to pour money into scholars. Who is going to decide all the questions? Who are going to be the rabbis who are going to run the shuls? Who's going to do that? Who are going to be the teachers in the schools? You need, Baruch Hashem, thousands of these kinds of people. Who's going to be that? These are the people, everyone agrees that when you're in medical school, you're only thinking about that. You eat, sleep, and drink it, right? You don't have time to go get a job then. And if you do, it's quite unusual, right? So the same thing, you're the Talmudic scholar, you may have to learn, and the Torah is much more vast than just medical knowledge, right? It might be he may have to study till he's 40. Till he's 40. And then he's ready to be the great scholar that people need, right? Maybe to be a teacher, you don't have to go to, whatever, I'm not debating, but I'm saying it becomes the community's responsibility, right? Even though the masses must synthesize Torah with work, they still need these individuals. And the totality of the Jewish people needs that every individual should develop to his highest potential. Okay? And when the individual does have the wherewithal to do that, it doesn't become his own personal gain, but it becomes a benefit to the entire Jewish people in either direct or indirect ways. This was the concept of giving presents to the priests in the Torah. Why do we give presents to the priests? The priests were the spiritual leaders. They have to, the truth is they didn't spend that much time in the temple. They only worked 2 weeks a year in the temple. What did they do the other 50 weeks? They were teaching Torah to everybody, the priests. They were the teachers. So they can't waste their time working in the fields. They gotta be teaching Torah to everybody. So you gotta give the priest 2% of your income, the Levite 10% of your income, and the other 23 presents that went to the priests. Why, are they a bunch of takers? No, they gotta live. If they live, they take your physical presence and transform them into spiritual blessings for you. And that becomes an advantage for the entire community over there. Okay? So this is clearly what's happening over here. There has to be a place, the majority of the people have to get a job. Gotta get a living, but you have to learn Torah. There has to be a minority. There has to be kolo people. There have to be the scholars that have to be funded. You don't have to fund them to the tune of $100,000 a year. Okay? You fund them to what they need to live by. And that's how they will thrive and become your leaders. And those people deserve our money. Because we will be the ultimate beneficiaries from that. So that's how it works out over here. There is the majority, and there is still the singulars over there. Okay, I'll take a pause for a minute if there's any questions or before I go further. This is a lot more to talk about still.
So is that kind of inversion of what you expect when Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying, no, but when Israel is going to be on a present, that will be performed by others?
So what he means is the individual.
Right.
He's saying like the individual is doing the wrong thing.
He says when their work is, it's a benefit to them. No, but when Israel is going to be on a present, their work is performed by others.
Right.
In other words, the others that perform the work for the Levites and the Kohanim maybe will perform the work that they can't themselves do at the level which those individuals, those elevate that elite does it.
Could be.
And
could be others will support them.
Right.
Yes.
So when Israel did not perform the will of the present, the work is cared
about. There he's talking about the individuals. Those individuals who should have dedicated their lives and did not. Oh, back to the introduction to that book. So back to the introduction of that book where the fellow was struggling what to do, right? So he decided from the sources, pre-Reb Chaim Volozhin, to go out and get a living. He went and got a living, was a successful businessman, and learned Torah too, like Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, enough that he could put out a sefer. He wrote a book on Torah knowledge. And he says, woe unto me that I didn't learn this Reb Chaim Volozhin before I made this decision. Because if I would have read it, I certainly would have stayed in the yeshiva, and he says by himself, I'm sure I would have been a great Rosh Yeshiva and would have been able to spread so much more Torah. That's what he says. So you see that it's a tremendous responsibility, we as parents, for our children. You have to know what the talents of your child are. If you have a child who can dedicate his life to spirituality, you're obligated to turn him in that direction. Now, you know that's a minority. If not, you're obligated to teach him to have an approach in which he will have a job but will learn Torah. But let's get that... Well, we'll leave the real fire and brimstone for the end. Okay, well, I want you to come back next week. Okay, let's go a little bit ahead now. Any other questions before we go on?
How do you know you're cut out for it?
I know you're cut out for it? You try, and then you see. Your child goes to school, right? Child goes to school, and you see how he does. You could tell. As an adult, it's not very wise to leave your livelihood.
You're saying if you kind of grow up in it, like...
If you grow into it and you see that, spiritual is really something here, but it would have to be in a way in which you could still survive. You know, or you'd be accepted into an institute of higher Jewish learning. But if not, then you have to be realistic. You know, a lot of times, for example, we'll tell a Baal Tshuva, let's say a Baal Tshuva, fourth year university. He's going for engineering, and he goes through Yerushalayim, gets all excited, wow, spirituality is great. I'm quitting university. So we'll tell him, nothing doing. You finish the fourth year university, then you go back to yeshiva. Make sure you've got that degree, because you may need it. Okay? And then you go sit 2, 3, 4 years, but you got the degree. That way you won't jeopardize that theory. Don't go flying off the handle in spirituality if you may not be able to be cut out for it. Okay, it's got to be sensibility here. There's got to be a balanced approach for most people. But there has to be a lot of respect for those who want to dedicate their lives to Torah. And you should weed out the ones who are mooching off the system. They shouldn't be there either. Okay? And those that are, honestly, these individuals, you wouldn't want to hurt their growth by sending them to the army. It's a very few. It's not going to make a difference for security. Takat halacha would be if we knew we needed every able body, which you really don't. But if you needed every able body in the country's existence dependent, then even the yeshiva students would have to go out. But that's never the case. That's never the case. You don't need every single able-bodied person, and the very few that would be in this range would not negatively affect any kind of military strategies. And as we know, take it on a deeper level, we know on a spiritual level, our success in war always depends on how the spiritual level is at anyway. So if you don't have these rabbis studying Torah, we're not going to win any wars.
Then how do you know who to give the charity for them to be able to? How do you go about it? How do you know which is the right person, which is the wrong person? You go by the yeshiva? Give the money to the yeshiva.
Oh, which money should you give? You give to reputable yeshivas. There's a lot of reputable
and
yeshivas.
And the yeshiva will
where they're producing scholars. There's some yeshivas that are just producing people to just study Torah without any goals. There are other yeshivas that are out to make goals. You know, this is okay. We'll talk more about it later. I have a lot more to say. But okay. we'll let's get through some more text. Correct. So the wife has to be very much attuned to that, and the girl has to be raised to appreciate what it means to be married to a Torah scholar. Okay, and that's the other point. Maybe you have a daughter who is spiritual, so she has to be the kind of person that maybe could be molded into that type of wife, who's going to really say, "I'm going to take care of all the mundane activities, so you're not burdened with that." You know, the great, great rabbis, you know, their wives ran the whole show in the house. I mean, they did everything. You know, when it was time for marrying off a daughter, and they did everything. What did the Rosh Yeshiva do? He had to change his suit. You know, they jokingly say that the rabbi, his wife took care of everything. He had to go to the wedding. he couldn't find the right coat or something, you know, for the wedding. I never sargittle bunning the pain in raising children.
So what happens if it's the daughter that is the one with the brilliant Torah mind?
So you make a movie Yentl.
Yeah.
Well, no, the truth is, the truth is that they can be teachers for women. Women need an education too. Women need an education too. You know, you have women that teach in seminaries that to develop this yahadus, this spirituality for other women. No question about it. Vilach, going into the gloss now. Vilach, therefore, Biparsha Rishona, the first chapter of the Shema, Shel Kriya Shema Ksiv, it says what? He's telling you what I said already. Ubechol Modecha, with all your money. First chapter. Because we're talking about the individuals. Ube parsha v'haya, but the second parsha, the second chapter starts with the word v'haya. Lo ksiva doesn't say, uvechol me'otchem, with all your resources. Why? Ki parsha shema, the first parsha of the shema, kula b'losh and yachid, is all in the singular nemra. The yachid and the individual shef shalom, that it's possible, hu tzarech l'kayim, he must fulfill the verse of Joshua of, v'yomish sefer Torah zem pichol, you should never let the Torah leave your lips. Exactly as the text says. Therefore it says, with all your money too. Perish, b'chol mamoch, with all your money. Of course, that kind of person, you have to give up everything. As it says in Brachas. Ratzolayim meaning to say, shalol, lasuk, b'parnasa, klal. Not to waste a minute working for these people. Avol parsha v'hoya, but the second chapter, Shenemra, Belush, and Rabin, that is said in the plural. The Rabin for the plural. Kimat Muchrochim. They're forced. Lisasik al Kolponim. Me'at gam berevach mom l'chayinam. They gotta work a little bit to make a living. L'chein lo'ksiv. Therefore, it cannot say, ubechol mo'otchem, with all your money. The masses can't live that way. Okay. Now, we'll take the next paragraph. V'hagam, and even though Shadayin lo zo haderech v'hamadrega ha-gavoha shebe-gavohos. Although this isn't the highest level, working and making a living, lefi amitas ritzona yisparach shmol v'das Reb Shimon Bar-Yochai, koin Reb Shimon Bar-Yochai, this isn't the ultimate level to synthesize Torah and study. But, in other words, he was asking is, so what's going on? Is this the will of God? The paragraph starts off saying, if you will listen to God and you're going to serve God not with all your money. Is this the will of God? It's not the highest level, but Im Kozel, even according to him. You can't say they're not doing the will of God. If they're spending a little time at work, even when they're working, when their hearts are filled with wisdom, and thinking about Torah and godliness, so you can't say it's not the will of God, it's not the ultimate. No, not everybody's cut out for the ultimate. 99% of people aren't cut out for the ultimate. No, it's just 1% for that. But is it not the will of God? You can't say it's not the will of God. It's just not the top. But according to Rabbi Shmuel, it's not so. Rabbi Shmuel, the one who says synthesize, Zohi Iker Ritzoni Yisbarach Ban Hagas Kalman. This is the way the master should conduct. So what is the argument of Rishim Bar Yochai and Rabbi Shmuel? Mahi Ikar Ritzon Yisbarach. What's the main will of God? V'madrega Yoser Gevor Ban Hagas Klalmon. What is the way things should be conducted now? Rabbi Shim Bar Yochai said, you know what? Everybody should try to do it. That was his opinion. Everybody should try to do it. Didn't work out. Rabbi Shmuel says, no, not everybody should try it. That's the argument. Now we come back to the point. So we took care of that piece. We left the cherubim, right? We got to come back to the cherubim a little bit. We are doing it's known. We're not going to get the full answer tonight. Shehakruvim, the cherubim, ha'echad, one of them, Ramas Alav Yisbarach Shemo, is symbolic of the Almighty. V'hasheni, and the second one, Al Yisrael Skulaso, is a symbol of the Jewish people, his chosen people. Ukafishir hiskorvusam utvekusam shel Yisrael elav Yisbarach Shemo, and to the level that the Jewish people cling and come close to the Almighty, O lehefech chas v'shalom, or the opposite, God forbid, to that level, hayenikar hakol beinyan amidas hakruvim derech nesvafela. It would be discernible to all through the way the keruvim would stand in a wondrous and miraculous way. Im peneim yashar, yechazu alav yisbarach shemo. If we would face God with a straight face, if our relationship with God is that we're always looking towards God and we're focused on our relationship with God, if that's the way we live our lives, gam ha-kruvim amdu az pneim ish al achiv, so the kruvim would be looking each one towards each other. Oim hafchu pneim ha-at u-mitzadi itzududei, but what if we didn't look so directly at God in our lives? And not everything we realize is with a relationship with God, or a little bit slanted, or whatever. Keno yonikar inyan tekef ba-kruvim. Immediately the kruvim would miraculously change. Oim chas v'shom hifnu aref. And if we would even turn our necks and backs against God, Gama Kruvim Karega, so would the Kruvim in an instant. Hifnu v'hafku pneim ish me'al achiv legamri chas v'shalom. They would turn their faces from each other, chas v'shalom as well. So what do you see from here? The entire issue of our receiving from God is dependent on, are you facing God? Are you not facing God? And that's the question you got to ask yourself. Am I really facing God in my life? Or have I decided, you know, in my own life that there are certain things I will do with Him and there are certain things I'll do without Him? You know, when I learn and when I daven and when I do mitzvahs, that's when I'm facing God. And when I'm at work and when I'm on a picnic and when I'm doing this and when I'm doing that, I'm not facing God. Right? Is that our attitude? Reb Chaim is saying it's all up to you. Are you facing God or not? And God responds in exact measure to that degree. To the degree, in other words, you get exactly what you're looking for. That's what he's saying over here. And if we're facing God, then God is always facing us in our relationship. And the cherubim would be the litmus test, would be the barometer. Let's look at the next page, Lamed. Ukeinyan shamru zal b'yoma, just as the Talmud tells us in Maseches Yoma, it says, at every one of the holidays, when all the Jews would converge upon Yerushalayim, what would the priests do? Shayu megalim haparoches, they would remove the curtain of the holiest of holies, laole regalim, to those who would come and visit. Umarin lem akruvin, they'd show them the cherubic-like figures, shayu meurim zebazeh, that were embracing one another. The Amrim Lehem, they would say to them, Ru'u chibaschem lifnei hamokom, see how dear you are before the Almighty, that you're still facing straight on. Okay, it doesn't say what happened when they were bad. Okay, but this wouldn't it be wonderful to always have that kind of barometer to know if the Almighty, if we were facing the Almighty or not, to be shown by how the cherubic-like figures looked like. So now, at this point, it's appropriate to bring in this question that we talked about last week, and that was, where does it come in, this idea of making images? Right? In Judaism, we veer very far away from any types of images. The Torah prohibits it. We don't believe in forms. And the reason why is because there's always a humanizing factor when you create forms. And Judaism strongly believes that God has no corporeality, it's no body, God is not limited, He's not physical in any way, He isn't affected by those things which affect bodily things, and that would be a total falsification of the concept of God in making some kind of form and some kind of structure. Because if you see this form of God, consciously or subconsciously, the person will relate to God as some kind of form, some kind of structure, and we don't want to look to create theologically confusing situations that could make us think the wrong thing. Fine. So that's why we can't have forms. So the question becomes, why do the cherubim have forms? Where is the form there?
You were saying they're like a barometer. They're not designed. Didn't they have a shield? War, that they were supposed to go to war, the Jewish people, the priests would put on the breastplate and
That was before they went to war. They would decide if they should go to war. The priest would consult with the breastplate to know if they should go to war. Yeah, but that wasn't a formed figure. But you're right. This is what Rav Dessler says. Rav Dessler says this is the distinction. If you're trying to define the essence of God in a form, if let's say the Keruvim were to define the essence of God, then it would be totally unacceptable. But that's not what the Keruvim are for. That's the whole point over here. The purpose of the Keruvim is to define the relationship of God to the Jewish people. That's the whole form. It's the definition of the relationship, not the definition of the essence of God. The definition of the relationship, that's very meaningful to the person. This is an area that a person has to know. You have to know what your relationship with God is. The essence of God we'll never know. In later chapters, he's going to talk a lot about this. He's going to spend 3 chapters on that whole idea. There's no way to know the essence of God. It doesn't help you to know the essence of God. It only helps you to know, to define the relationship that God created. That's not his essence. The relationship he creates with us at every step of the way, that's very crucial. Now that doesn't lessen our recognition of God. It's the opposite. It heightens our recognition of what that relationship is with us. And that ultimately is our whole job in this world, is to understand how does God relate to the world, not what's his essence. So for that we have the right to make the Keruvim. To make anything that would define his essence, we've got no business doing that. That's only damaging. But that if we can contrive something, not we, God tells us, to know how our relationship is with God. That we have to know. That's what being a Jew is all about, to know what your relationship with God is all about. And that's what the Keruvim serve, and that's why you're allowed, that's why God said you can have Keruvim.
The Keruvim are a barometer for the people as a whole, or individuals?
As the collective people.
As the collective people. So you could go there and get the, you could go there and be, not be a yeshar and still look.
Okay, you have to know. We don't know how God measures the collective. Okay, it's hard to know how he's measuring all that, how he measures the collective.
But if we have in the galut,
it's not our business. It's not our business, right? Then God can deal with every individual on a different basis. Remember, when people were sick in those days, if you got sick, that became your individual issue. You went to the prophet. The prophet told you what you did wrong. But as the collective Jewish people, is God with us or not with us? You'll know. You'll know what the Keruvim are doing over there. Okay?
Where did Shlomo get the idea of doing the big ones? I mean, it isn't mentioned anywhere in the book. And so, if there are Keruvim, I mean, there were Keruvim
I'm still in the middle of checking that out. It was a different set of Keruvim.
I haven't figured that out.
It was prophetic. It's obviously prophetic.
So he was allowed to do that. I mean, they had painted on the
parochus. Yeah, I have to look more into that. I'm in the middle of checking that out. But it's definitely they were not on the parochus, on the kaporis. It was not on the aron. It was on the floor. It was a separate set. But that's a good question. It's a side point, but clearly our relationship was reflective. I got to do a little more research on that. But let's just try to finish the chapter. Now he brings you the Zohars again. Uba Zohar Truma, and in the Zohar and Parshas Truma, it says like this, skip down to the brackets. Masai hi barachamim. How do you know when God is facing us with love? Amalei, he says, b'shah shakruvim achzirim, when the kruvim are turning back, umistakling ponim b'ponim, facing face to face. Kevin shehem hakruvim istakling ponim upon him, once you see the cherubic like figures are facing face to face, as kol hagvanim, then we know that all the different conducts of the spiritual worlds above, mistaknim, they're all in a state of correction. Kamosha mistadrin yisrael tikunim shal kadosh baruch hu, just like the Jewish people have fixed up and repaired all the worlds on our level, kachomet hakol v'kach mistadr, everything else is arranged. That's one Zohar. In the next paragraph, another Zohar, Uparshas Achrei, it says, on the verse, Hine matovu manoim shevet achim gam yachad, how wonderful and pleasant it is, brothers living together, look at the brackets, shevet achim, brothers sitting together, ki b'shosh, ayu mistaklim zeh bo zeh, panim b'panim, when they would see the cherubic-like figures facing each other, they'd break out in song, Hine matov umanoyim. How wonderful and pleasant it would be. Ukisha hazocher, when the male cherubic-like figure, which was symbolic of God, machzer panav mina nekeva, when the male figure turns his face away from the female figure, which is representative of us, oy la olam, woe unto the world when that happens. A lot of times when things are going very bad for us, we say it's an occasion of hester panim, where God is acting as if he's hiding his face from us. He's turning his face away from us. Know that he's turning his face only because we turned our face away from him. That's what we have. Final paragraph here. Ubezohar Chadash, and in the Zohar in another place, skip all the way down to the bracket again. Bechol zman shehayu Yisrael zakoyim, whenever the Jewish people were meritorious, hakruvim hayu dvukim bedveikus panim v'panim, the cherubic figures would be cleaving face to face. The cave and Yucholtim, when the Jews would be sitting, Hayu Machsirim Pneim Zemizah, they turned their faces away. Val Cain, therefore, Hakruvim Bosas Man, Shoy Yisrael Zakoyim, when the Jews were meritorious, Hayu Panim Panim, they were face to face. Val Sodas Elu, and on these secrets, Hayu Yodim Im Yisrael Haim Zakoyim, the Jews would know if we're meritorious or not. Kasuv, as it says, Ivdu Es Hashem Besimcha, serve God with joy, Simchaso Shol Shnei Akruvim, the joy of seeing the two Kruvim facing each other. Cave and Shashur Aleihem, since God rests on them, Choser Lios B'Simcha, there is Simcha, V'olam Choser Lios B'Racham, and the world is with mercy. Look there in great length. So it comes out, it's not all, it's a second point he's bringing out over here. Not only the issue for facing Hashem, but what's the Zohar adding in the Ivdu Es Hashem B'Simcha part now? It's not just that we face God in terms of, are we doing the mitzvahs, but also, how we're doing the mitzvahs are critical. Two people can face each other and do what is expected of each other. You can have a husband and wife. The wife is doing what she's supposed to do, what's expected. The husband's doing what he's expected, but you could be doing it in a glum way. And you can have sour faces towards each other. So the Zohar says, if you want to get the real sense of the love to come into the world from the Almighty, then your service to God has to be with joy. Okay? And God's going to mirror back that kind of behavior to you. Okay? So now, okay, so we answered, how many questions so far? We answered the brachas, we didn't answer the kruvim. We'll leave that for next week. Okay? Let me hang you on a little bit more. But he's developing this idea. We're not tomorrow. Next week we still have to address. We didn't finish the total idea about working and learning. There's still what to say, and we have to answer the question why were King Solomon's Kruvim still not facing directly head on, right? But I think we definitely got a lot to tonight. Is there anything? Wanted some questions over there. Carol, did you have some questions? We can.
They were more general. I'll come in for
that. Yeah. Anybody else?
Hey, what about your first question about the golden calf?
The golden calf.
They weren't worshiping it technically, but they were sort of using it as a conduit. They thought
right.
To define a relationship with Hashem.
They said Moshe. It wasn't really God.
Okay, but the problem was, as the commentary say, but God didn't tell you to do it. God didn't
right.
tell you to do it. You're going on your own. It loses, doesn't have any sanctity to it. And the question is was it as to define the relationship as much as it was to be some kind of representation of God? Even if it was for relation, I'd say even if it was to determine the relationship, if God didn't tell you to do this, it can have no sanctity to it. Okay.